I read Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation, and that book was the book that convinced me this is like what this medium can do. And then I just adore that book and I adore that series. And it is so inspirational for me. And it made me believe that I could be a professional writer. And that was like, you know, this memory that lingered in my mind the entire time that I was writing Mushroom Blues, the entire time I was creating the fungal verse, is Annihilation and what that book did to me and how it, much like Hugh Howey broke my conception of publishing, Jeff Vandermeer broke my conception of literature. And I thought, like, if I could ever write anything as powerful as this, I could die happy.
What is up, everybody? You are listening to episode 96 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host today, MJ Kuhn, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. You have probably already noticed this is a little bit of a different episode because my co-pilot is actually our esteemed guest of the day. So today, of course, we are celebrating the release of his debut novel, Mushroom Blues. So everybody, if you haven't pre-ordered it or gone and picked it up yet, what are you doing? Go grab you some Mushroom Blues. We're going to talk all about it today.
Get as colonized.
Well. Yes, go and get colonized. As well, a quick note for our listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live. So check the links in the description to support what we do here. And don't forget to rate and review the show on your favorite podcast application and subscribe to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel where this and every other episode is available in full video. And now, formally welcoming today's guest, which is funny because you're just always here with me. It's Adrian M. Gibson. Yeah, you're here. Who are you? My wonderful co-host, Han Solo to my Chewie, and the author of the newly released Mushroom Blues. Hi, Adrian. Welcome to the interviewee's chair. How are you?
I'm good, MJ. You killed it. You killed it, girl.
Yay!
I'm very, very happy I'm very happy that, like, I was thinking about it earlier. We haven't done an episode, just the two of us. Obviously, we do the playlist and everything, but we haven't done one since the first two episodes that we recorded together.
That we ever recorded, yeah.
Yeah. The ones where I interviewed you, and that was 60 episodes ago.
Yeah, I was going to say that was in 2022. That was, yeah. I mean, I think it aired in 2023.
Aired maybe, in 2023.
We recorded it in 22, yeah.
But that was episode 36 and 37, and it was like...
So it's exactly 60 episodes ago. That's like kind of cute almost.
It's cute. Aww.
It's cute. It's
adorable. We've been friends for more than 60 episodes.
Right? Oh, that actually is fun because it's like more than 60 weeks, over a year.
Yeah.
Me and besties. Well, I'm very excited to interview you today. First of all, just because I'm excited to talk to you about Mushroom Blues, but also I'm excited to give you a little bit of a break from the main hosting seat and let you just be in the hot seat. Today.
Like I haven't been doing that for like the last month and a half.
I know, right? On everybody else's show. Now you just get to receive the SFF Addicts treatment and feel how it feels.
Yeah. I'm down for that.
So let's kick things off. I feel like our regular listeners already know you pretty well. But for any new listeners or, you know, folks that just, you know, haven't heard from you in a little while, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your past, your history in the bookish world?
Yeah. So I obviously, like, I created SFF Addicts back in 2021, brought this beautiful MJ on in 2023. And now I'm very, very happy to be co-hosting with you and just kind of enjoying this podcasting adventure in its new era. And aside from that, I started out writing reviews and stuff for FanFi Addict, book blog, and just transitioned into podcasting because I found that was an avenue that I enjoyed a lot more. And that just kind of set me up in a bit of a selfish way, but also because I knew I could put stuff out into the world and people could listen to it and consume it. But I just wanted to talk to authors and pick their brains about stuff that I was curious about, whether it was craft or genre or publishing or marketing or what have you. And SFF Addicts was kind of like the foundation upon which I accrued the confidence to release my debut novel, to self-publish my debut novel. And it feels really cool now to be on this like new journey and this kind of this new era of my life, you know, because I've gone through a lot of different eras. It's like being a music journalist and being a tattoo artist and illustrator and graphic designer and then podcaster and then father and, you know, stay-at-home dad. And now I can add author to my already fucking eclectic
mix. Very long list of titles. I love that though, because I do think that, I mean, everybody, every author I've ever talked to has a radically different journey from the beginning stages of working on a book to, you know, becoming a published author. But I do think with the podcast, it's such a unique journey that's so fun to talk about. And I mean, yes, it may have had selfish origins. And, you know, honestly, like me coming on has selfish origins too, because I just want to pick the brains of these authors. I talk about it all the time. I'm taking notes. I have a notebook up here. I always do.
I hear MJ scribbling every once in a while.
Oh, yeah. I'm always like, oh, let me remember that note for later. But here's the thing is it's, you know, if it's, we are both writers and a lot of our listeners are writers. And if it's useful information for us, it's useful information for our listeners.
Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Novello is an exciting new publishing and reading platform whose goal is to be the go-to for all things writing and storytelling. Their platform offers an intuitive, user-friendly way for writers to create and share their awesome stories for readers to enjoy, all while maintaining total control over their stories. Everything from the content to cover art and pricing is all controlled by the story's author. Novello also offers social features such as message boards, direct messaging, and a news feed, where you can post updates to your followers. With future plans including support for comics and a marketplace for users to sell other writing-related services, the future of this platform is looking bright. And the best part? It's all available for free. No sign-up fees, no membership, just a growing library of epic tales. Sign up now to bask in the magic of books, where you can enjoy tales like Blackwater, an epic adventure by an award-winning author, or Limbo, The Door Above the Lake, a terrifying battle for survival. Whether you're a casual reader or a professional writer, Novello is the place for you. Visit them at novello.com. That's N-O-V-E-L-O.com. And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts.
So yeah. I want to talk a little bit more and dig a little deeper into how your experience with the podcast shaped your journey into authorhood, because I know we've talked a little bit about, you know, self-publishing in particular. It can be really intimidating, which is why I haven't attempted it yet. Do you feel like, you know, meeting all these people and talking to them and getting to pick their brains gave you the confidence to move into that realm? Can you talk a little bit about how it shaped your journey?
Well, SFF Addicts single-handedly convinced me not to go trad.
So, I wonder why.
I wonder why. If anyone has listened to this podcast, you've probably heard plenty of authors talk about how just brutal traditional publishing can be. And it's mostly from the perspective of the various ego smashing hurdles that you have to push through and jump over. It's like getting a manuscript to a point where you feel confident enough to pitch it to an agent, getting an agent, and you could fail to get an agent a lot of times. And, or you could get an agent and it turns out that agent is shit and you don't have like a good relationship or anything, or you feel like that's not beneficial for you. And then on top of that, that agent has to pitch your book to editors at different publishers. And there's no guarantee that anyone's going to pick it up or anyone's going to like it. There's no guarantee. And so you could go through these processes and spend years just, you know, like Andrea Stewart is an amazing, amazing human being, very resilient. It took her 10 years to get her book published. And in those years, it was, she did get an agent. She wrote books. Those books got rejected. And she kept going and kept going. And Bone Char Daughter is the one that ended up selling. But by the time her journey kind of started to the moment where the Bone Char Daughter got published was almost a decade. And to me, I'm like, I'm not old. As much as MJ would like to say she's old, even
though I was gonna say we're exactly the same age. So sure, but, I like that you're not old.
Yeah. But I don't want to spend my 30s struggling over that kind of stuff when I already have so much stress in my life with like kids and everything else that goes on. So I would rather the stress be directly in my hands and directly under my control, as opposed to a ton of what ifs. And so the podcast just set me up for that. It was like, hey, your dream of getting an agent and getting published by a trad author, here's a big fucking reality check. And that was just like, from day one, you know, like my first guest was Hugh Howey talking about self-publishing. And he just like broke down the sort of like structural integrity of my dream.
Which sounds so brutal, but
it is though, but it's like, it's kind of like, the kind of destruction that kind of tears you down to your core and allows you to rebuild something that is more, honest to you and more beneficial for your sensibilities and your skills and what you have in terms of like, this is my idea for the trajectory of my career. And for me, it was like more and more and more. Hugh Howey just kind of like crushed it in the beginning. And I love Hugh. Right. He's a great, great, great guy. But he was very blunt about these things that he's experienced. And that progression just convinced me more and more, like everything I've done in my past, music journalism was, you know, freelance and very self-driven. Tattooing started out freelance and very self-driven. Podcasting started out completely self-driven. So why not apply this punk kind of mentality, this very experimental mentality, this very self-driven mentality to being an author as well?
I love that. I love that. Yeah, because I've always said, you know, a lot of people come in not knowing anything. Everyone comes in not knowing anything unless you have family or friends that have done it before, right? You think trad is the only quote unquote option, or at least, you know, I did in the beginning and things like
but
that.
But it's also like scene. There's also like the misconception and the judgments toward self-publishing where someone's like, oh, you want to be an author, like who are you going to get published with and blah, blah, blah. And they have this idea of these big
publishing houses. Yeah, there's almost like a stigma. I think it's going away, the self-publishing stigma. Either that or I'm just hanging out with cooler people. You know what I mean?
I think it's like the self-publishing crowd is becoming more confident and is becoming more, especially in SFF, just rife with very talented people writing very good books who are thinking more about the complexities of what it takes to be self-published in terms of, you know, presentation with the right cover and the right design and typography, the right approach to a story in terms of, you know, being open to experimentation, but also knowing like the genre conventions that you're working in. Having people that you collaborate with in terms of editors and artists who are very talented. And I think that like the rise of much more, a much more plentiful amount of artists and editors that people can choose from who are very, very good has also been adding to the quality of the self-published books that are coming out. So it's like, there is collaboration and self-publishing, even though it's called self-publishing. There are so many people that are involved in that process. But the more professional and the more talented those people involved are, the more likely that end product is already up to a higher degree of quality.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's more about, I think a lot of people have the misconception or used to that self-publishing is like, oh, I couldn't get a trad deal, so I'm self-publishing.
Exactly.
But it's more about a trade-off. It's more about a trade-off. Do you want more control over, you know, the presentation and the timeline and all of the things, or do you want a larger distribution arm? That's really what it boils down to.
And that's the only
to.
Thing that trad can give you at this point. Is
yeah,
distribution.
It isn't already offered.
Marketing, 100%. Marketing, for the most part, is a fucking illusion. Yeah. I know, like, indie authors work their asses off to market, but most trad authors do the same amount of work, even though they have the supposed, backing of
yeah.
the traditional publisher. And so it's like, what the fuck is the point? You know,
yeah.
if you want that distribution, I understand. But now more than ever, there are means of distribution for indie authors. And you're already putting in the work of marketing and all these different things. So there's very little incentive, I think. And like you said, a lot of it comes down to sort of an understanding of what is involved with self-publishing, at least to the degree that you can get past that intimidation factor.
Yes. Yeah, because it's scary. Oh my God.
Well, having gone through it, I can say it can be scary. There are so many things that you can just like fumble and fuck up, but the ability to pivot and reorient yourself is so much more rapid and flexible that even if those things happen, you can still find a way around it. You can still find a solution. And there are just so many resources out there that, like, I'm lucky because I have a lot of people that I can reach out to about that as well. And I think the biggest hurdle with the intimidation factor is deciding, like, I am going to do this, and then start going through it, you know, trial by fire kind of deal.
Absolutely. Well, making that decision, that's actually a great accidental segue here, because you know this question's coming. You know this question's coming. We always ask it. I need to ask you what your gateway drug book, movie, show that brought you into the nerdy fold was, and how that, like, what was the timeline between that point when you joined us on the Dark Side of Nerds, and then you decided you wanted to write your own nerdy story?
I was born on the dark side, MJ. You know this.
Same girl.
You know, like Dylan Marsh and Charles MC from the FTF podcast dubbed me the bad boy of SFF. So I was born for this, baby.
You were born bad.
No, but like my early introductions to it were, it was kind of a mix of like the classics, you know, like my grandma was British. So Narnia and The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, Brian Jocks. Like, I know you and I have this mutual love for the Redwall series. I adore it so much. And I think every once in a while, I just kind of like have nostalgic moments where I think about the feasts in the Redwall series.
Oh my God, right.
And it makes
me
so happy.
So hungry reading
it. Yeah, it's so good. But then they're also kind of like very, very kid-oriented books, like Lemony Snicket and A Series of Unfortunate Events. Captain Underpants was my jam back in the day. And that was more of a comic. And that was like sci-fi.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Like, I think about it now and I'm like, that is super sci-fi. You know, there's like big robot battles and like weird aliens and shit. And here's Captain Underpants, this fat, bald dude, like in a pair of underwear and these two kids. And I'm just like, I adored it. But that kind of sparked a love for both fiction in written form and fiction through comic book visual forms. So I had like both of these pillars in my like imaginative bucket, like comics and visual stuff and illustration and drawing and writing and, you know, just like what the written form could do. And so it's like, as I got older, it's like, you know, reading more, you know, Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. And I was the age, like we were the age of Harry Potter, more or less in the books as they were coming
out. Like literally reading the books, waiting for my Hogwarts letter. 100% remember that. Yeah,
exactly. And so those are really formative for me. But then it's kind of like in high school, I petered out a bit. You know, the last Harry Potter book came out when I was in my graduating year. And my mom bought it for me because she's like, I know you used to love this series. And I was like, I actually kind of still do. But she bought it for me, even though I was like, I wasn't going to go get it myself.
Yeah, but she was like, here you go. You got to finish the set.
Exactly. She's like, how much fucking time did I spend on you and this series, taking you to the movies and everything? But high school was kind of when things petered out. And it wasn't until I was in university where I took a course in fourth year on post-apocalyptic landscapes was the name of the course. And we watched The Matrix. We watched Apocalypse Now. We read and watched The Road. There was an Angela Carter book. I can't remember exactly what it was called. I think it was like Blood and something, but it was kind of like post-apocalyptic fantasy, which was really cool. Margaret Atwood, her Oryx and Crake series, which is fantastic. And then Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which inspired Blade Runner.
Yeah.
That class just reinvigorated my love for SFF. And after the teacher was so eccentric, just like her hair was dyed purple and she was like just this really short, scrawny lady. And she was obsessed with this stuff, like obsessed with it.
I love it. I honestly, I have a new life goal then. I want to become that teacher.
The thing is, she was like really shitty orator. So it was kind of inconvenient that the content was really good. No. But she just like went on these tangents. She would go on so many tangents about Star Trek in particular. And I was like, we're not here for Star Trek. We're here for post-apocalypses. Get the fucking
program. She's like, I'm here for Star Trek always. Yeah, always.
But then after I graduated, I moved to Berlin. And Berlin was where I started exploring much more sci-fi and fantasy and kind of just went in deep with this like reinvigorated adoration for these genres. And there's this really cool bookstore in Berlin called Otherworld that's specifically sci-fi and fantasy, like just that. There's some horror as well, but you know, everyone who worked there is super nerdy and really good recommendations and just like wide breadth of books that they've read. And that's where I was introduced to like the New Weird movement with Jeff Vandermeer and China Mieville, and reading more Philip K. Dick and seeing like who are like the new sci-fi and fantasy authors that are coming out. And so it's really cool for me to be able to experience that and have that be the sort of impetus for me to think more seriously about writing. And because I'd done like fanfic comic books back in the day, but I never wrote fanfic or anything like that. And then throughout my 20s, I was basically like experimenting, you know, like these are ideas that I have and I would start a story but never finish it. But I read Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation. And that book was the book that convinced me this is like what this medium can do. And then I just adore that book and I adore that series. And it is so inspirational for me. And it made me believe that I could be a professional writer. And that was like, you know, this memory that lingered in my mind the entire time that I was writing Mushroom Blues, the entire time I was creating the Fungal Verse, is Annihilation and what that book did to me and how it, much like Hugh Howey broke my conception of publishing, Jeff Vandermeer broke my conception of literature. And I thought, like, if I could ever write anything as powerful as this, I could die happy, you know?
Right. Oh my gosh. I love it. Well, you could definitely see the, as someone who is special and fortunate and got to read Mushroom Blues already, you can definitely see the influence, right, of Vandermeer and all of that. I want to talk, obviously, about Mushroom Blues now, because we've, you know, we've been squirreling around it a little bit. But, like, let's dive into the star of the hour, this beautiful debut novel you have.
The fruiting body of the hour.
Yes, the fruiting body of the hour. Such an evocative term. I mean, it's perfect, but I do need it.
How did you get through this book? I don't even know how many times I use fruiting body.
Oh my God, every like time I saw it, I wanted to text you every time I saw it. Yeah. And be like, Adrian, do you use it again? But here's the thing is it was the perfect phrase to use. Those
contextually,
you know what I mean?
Contextually, it's like it works so well. Yeah.
Yeah, it worked really well. It's unsettling, but it's meant to be.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's start. I was going to ask you, is Mushroom Blues the first novel length work of fiction you've written? But this has been spoiled for me because I was in a live reading you did the other day, earlier this week. And you mentioned that it's not, and then reminded me that Mushroom Blues was actually meant to be a novella. It was supposed to be a novella to start with. So I want to talk a little bit about that because we've talked a lot about novellas recently on this show. You and I both love novellas. We have an appreciation for the novella. I just want to talk about how that journey, how it went, right? What ended up happening? How did it end up taking shape instead as a full-length novel?
Yeah. So the first book I wrote in the fungal verse is actually going to be the second book I release, which is the start of a separate series than the Hoffman Report. That one, I kind of like got to this point where it was like, I'd finished a first draft and kind of hated it. Like, there's so much about it that I love.
Every first draft mood. Yeah.
There's so much that I love about it. And I know it's like, there's a solid story in there. But that middle just like crushed me. That slog just crushed me. And so I got to the end of it and I was like, fuck this. I'd never revised anything at that point. But then I had this plan. I was going to release this book and then I was going to do, coincide with the launch or to like lead up to the launch, I was going to do, a freebie giveaway for people who signed up for my newsletter. And that was this, I was like, there's so much that happens before, in terms of like what I'd done in world building and the spore war and all these things that kind of play into the history of this world. And I was like, I'm going to write a prequel novella that starts after the spore war. And is kind of like a tight nugget of noir, you know? And that was the beginning of Mushroom Blues, was this idea for the freebie giveaway. And I started writing that as a way to like get over my frustrations with the other book that I had finished. I was like, I need to like exist in the same world, but I need to just like step away from it. And what ended up happening is I outlined that entire novella, but I didn't know how to outline back then. I'd outlined a novella. It was like 14 chapters, but within each chapter, I was like, this could be broken up into like at least two or three or four chapters, each fucking chapter.
Yeah.
You know? And so I was like, that right there is like enough to expand this into a full book. And I just started kind of like reading through the outline and like, I really like these characters. And Koji, who is in the other book, but older, is, I was like, he's in this book and younger, and it's kind of cool to be able to explore him, and his sort of like younger experiences in this city and this world. And I just kept going with it. And then kept going with it. And Henrietta Hoffman, the main character, started out as a man. But then I was like, he at that time was not working.
Yeah.
And it felt too much like the stereotypical lead in noir and police procedurals and murder mysteries. And not that I'm like hating on any of that, but it felt too much like me attempting to tap into like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. And so much of what came after with like Blade Runner and Rick Deckard, or pretty much like every fucking crime thriller or murder mystery or like
noir story here.
Yeah. There's just like, you know, like Chinatown or are all these different movies and TV shows and books. And then I switched her, I switched that character from a man to a woman, and then I switched it from third person to first person. And that decision made everything click.
Not everything the best came feeling together.
Yeah.
When you make it, that like switch, oh, and it's God, like, dude. This is what I've been looking for. Yeah.
And everything just flowed from that. And I was like, okay, so it's like first person. So it's much more intimate. And that actually really works well for a tight perspective within this kind of genre, you know, like having the intimacy of a detective who is both personally complex in the deep facets of their personal history and their traumas, but also the way that they view the current world that they exist in and how that reflects on the story as a whole and how that acts as a vehicle through which the mystery unfolds. And so that just expanded. All of this happened, mind you, in February of last year.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's pretty recent.
Yeah. So it didn't take me that long to write this book. It was like a year-long process. And I just made the call. I was like, I really like where this is going. And I booked Felix Ortiz as my cover artist because it's like we're friends. So I was able to DM him and just like, hey, I'm going to do a cover with you. He's like, yep, cool. I can get it to you in the fall. And
love
just
it. Like, yeah, and if you want to work with Felix, you got to get that in advance.
Exactly. Everything just started flowing from there. And I realized like there is so much to this story. And it felt right for this one to be the introduction to the Fungalverse because it's from the perspective of an outsider who doesn't understand the intricacies of this world. Whereas the one that I wrote before is much more like, these are people who are more embedded in the world. And there's not as much of a chance for the very unfamiliar setting and the fungal people that inhabit this world, inhabit this city and this country and the complex socio-political dynamics that are going on. I was like, this needs to be the first introduction, even though it is a challenging POV to read. It was a challenging POV for me to write, but you've read it. So you kind of understand the payoff of that.
Yeah. Well, she goes on a journey. I think that that's, I very much value a character that's a bit of a dick in the early chapters. Mm-hmm. I mean, looking I like a character that's looking at just like a bit of a
every
dick in general,
Joe Abercrombie character ever. Yes. Many of them never stop being dicks as well.
Right. And we love them for it. Cough, cough, yeah. Glockta, cough, cough.
Yeah. Stairs.
Those damn stairs.
Fucking stairs.
But no, I think you do it very well. And I think readers are really going to respond to Hoffman's journey. And I do think, to your point, it was, as a reader, very, again, though the POV is challenging and the character is not necessarily the most likable person on page one, it was helpful to be introduced to the world, like you said, through the lens of this outsider that doesn't understand, because we don't understand because it's a new world for us and we're exactly. readers. You made it up.
Yeah.
Well, I want to kind of talk a little bit about the kind of fish out of water experience, because I feel like that's an experience that you yourself have lived. You've had an interesting
multiple
life.
Times.
You've lived in multiple different countries, multiple different cultures. You know, you mentioned moving to Berlin. You now live in Ecuador. You are from Canada. So how have these experiences and, you know, that lived experience of being the outsider in a new culture. What ways has that shaped your fiction writing?
So many ways. It's basically like that travel that I've done living in different countries, living in Europe for 3.5 years and traveling around Europe at the same time. It's like I lived in Berlin, but I traveled to like Norway and Denmark and Holland and Italy and Croatia and all of these different places, Czech Republic, France, and Spain, and all over the place, and experiencing the very jarring shift that, you know, Canada for me is such a homogenous country in a lot of ways. And I know for you, like some parts of the States can be like that as well, especially the Midwest.
Yeah.
So to go to a place where you could cross a border that was closer than me crossing the border of provinces within Canada and experiencing this incredible shift from I was in Germany and now I'm in Spain. And
yeah,
the ways in which culture completely changed, language completely changes, cuisine completely changes, all these different things that change in an instant and make you realize like these things that make us human are so integral to our experiences and they are so malleable. There's a lot of sort of diffuse influence all over the world of like, go to Spain and there are a lot of parts of Spain that's like their cuisine or their architecture is reflective of Northern Africa because of the Moors invading Spain. You know, I can't remember the exact century, but hundreds of years ago. Or there are even words in Spanish that are directly pulled from Arabic, you know, or going to Italy and seeing like how different Rome is versus Naples and how the identity of these people, you know, like one of my friends, he grew up on the Amalfi Coast in Italy and speaking to his dad, and his dad is like, I don't view myself as Italian. I'm Napolitano. And to me, that was just like, whoa.
Yeah.
That even national identity was malleable, you know? And so it completely changed my perspective on what culture means, what society means, what, you know, like nationality means, all these different things. And then coming to Ecuador is like the same thing. You know, there's so much shared history between, you know, like Ecuador and Peru or Colombia. But then there are so many things that are within that, that are completely shaped by local influences, you know, like the indigenous people in the way that they still continue to use their language of Quechua, or the ways in which the Incan Empire affected so much of this, or the colonization of the Spanish and the conquistadors that came. And so for me, it's been really important to understand how places shape people and how that affects language and so many different things that make us human, that make us societies, that make us, you know, individuals, but also part of communities. And so that'll play a huge part in Mushroom Blues, where the differences between the fungal people, the mushroom-headed people that are native to this island nation of Japón, and the human people who are basically inhabiting the rest of the world, but specifically this one country, Caprinia, and the invasion that occurs where Caprinia and the humans invade Japón and the fungal people and then occupy their nation and occupy their capital city, you know, in this kind of like subversion of the colonizers, mushrooms becoming the colonized. Right. And so that cultural and sort of like ideological and societal difference played a huge part in how these two cultures clash and the ways in which the cultural truths that were sold to the humans in terms of this is why this war is justified. This is why this occupation is justified. But then actually boots on the ground being there, Henrietta's just like, you know, she hates mushrooms. She's mycophobic. And so it's not a fun place for her to be. But then she's kind of like confronted with the things that she's seeing, the subjugation that these fungals are suffering under, the food shortages and rationing that they're subjected to, the abuse by military and humans in general, the slurs that are thrown at them, the different forms of racism and how that takes shape. Henrietta, even though she starts out as a very kind of like curmudgeon-y character, this investigation that she is forced to pursue completely reshapes and much, you know, like with Hugh Howey and with Jeff Vandermeer, it's like the breaking down of perceived truths in order to rebuild something that feels much more genuine for that individual. And so Henrietta's experience is like, the things that I experienced traveling and living in different countries, Henrietta goes through this process of dissolving her sense of reality and her sense of self in order to come back and be able to rebuild it in her image, the way that she perceives the world and the truths that she believes in her core, as opposed to what institutions and governments are selling her.
Right. Well, and I think this is a good opportunity for us to kind of move into talking about world building too, because the world that you've created, you've talked about it a little bit, obviously the island nation of Hapan, the city of Neokonoko, which I didn't realize that Konoko means mushroom, and in that Japanese. Was a fun discovery.
And actually every part of this world, so it's like Coprinia is a genus of mushrooms. There's a nation called Svepuria, which is Icelandic for mushroom. There's a kind of like countries that are based on sort of real world nationalities and cultures. There's one that's called Chanterelle, which is like kind of an analog to French. There's Cetero, which is like Spanish. There are a ton of like the entire world is just shaped around types of mushrooms and the ways in which mushroom is expressed in different languages.
I love that so much. Well, that's peek behind the curtain. I was telling you, Adrian, I was telling you the other day, when I was writing my blurb for Mushroom Blues, I was trying so hard to find mushroom words that I could put into it because I was like, it's just so, it's a fun opportunity.
The puns are just
put
waiting.
Those mushroom words in there. Yeah. Yes, they're there. But even beyond the mushroom puns, which are great, the world building that you've done, the world is so well realized. And I feel like it's such a creative, I've never read anything quite like it, right? Where it's, you know, the city, there's so many things made of mushrooms. There's so many things that are interconnected. And I'm curious, what is your world building process like? We haven't talked a ton about your planning process. I know you mentioned you worked off an outline. So I take it you're more of a plotter, less of a pantser. But like, how do you build your world?
This is a very particular case because I spent like 2 years world building before I wrote anything solid. So it's like almost 6 years ago where I had a dream about a mushroom towering over the trees in a forest, like this bioluminescent mushroom that's just like showering this glade in spores. And there was just such a vivid dream. And I woke up and I wrote it down. Because I always have like a notepad next to my bed, or at least like in the drawer. Tip, just have some writing utensil next to you.
Notes app on your phone at the very least. Yeah.
Or just like wherever you go. Obviously phones kind of make that a lot easier these days, but I'm an analog guy in certain ways. That dream sparked just this torrential vomiting of illustration and reading and research where I was like going hard, drawing a ton of stuff like Koji here, you know, imagining like a fungal world, you know, like Jeff Vandermeer really inspired me with Annihilation, but he also inspired me a lot with his Ambergris trilogy, which started out with City of Saints and Mad Men, which I believe was his debut novel, which is more of like a short story collection actually. And then Shriek and Finch. Finch in particular this is like a world that is like kind of like whale punk is like a good way of kind of describing it, where there's like, you know, a big focus on sort of like seafood and the ocean and how it affects this you know, like seaside city. But then like it turns out the city is actually built on the land of these fungal people that were then pushed underground. And a lot of what happens over the course of this series is like the fungal people returning and reclaiming the city. But they're much more, these fungal people are like much more insidious. They're much more of like a hive mind. It's like a quiet menace. And the humans are the ones being subjugated. And so a lot of the Fungalverse ended up becoming a conversation with Jeff Vandermeer's work. Like, how can I create a world of fungal people that feels more individual and human, but also kind of encapsulates these interconnected aspects of fungi and the ways in which community can play into that. And so the very, very early conception was like, how can I kind of write a sort of travelogue from the perspective of an unnamed character who's the outsider in this mushroom kingdom? And it was much more like fantasy at that point. And that was an exploration of how mushrooms can change our perceptions of what humans are capable of with engineering and architecture and community and different aspects that make up our societies, how that might be influenced by mushrooms, and how in the real world we could actually apply mushrooms in certain ways to better society through things like mycoremediation, which is basically like using mushrooms in order to remediate the damage on a given ecosystem or what have you.
That humans do.
Like cleaning up cleaning up oil spills, for instance. But I realized like that I spent so much time world building and kind of creating these like fungal people and their society, and how Japan was a big inspiration for their world and their culture. But I realized like this travelogue idea was way too fucking preachy and it wasn't going to work. And so I kind of like shelved it, but I kept the world. And I thought, how can I make this more interesting, to put it lightly? Like, how can I present this world in such a way where it's like an engaging story that feels like the world isn't being shoved down your throat? The messages are not being shoved down your throat. And so that's when I started pulling in these genres that I really love: cyberpunk and noir and murder mysteries. And, you know, that became Spore City, which was the first book that I wrote. And I kind of continued that with like other ideas of how to approach the Fungalverse, which is what I ended up naming it, with this mentality of combining genres in this really rich world that I'd spent years imagining. And so I think it's a very inapplicable lesson to people out there, because I feel like too many authors get sucked into that trap of world building endlessly and creating a history and creating whatever and not spending the time actually writing. You know, like there's a world, but there's no narrative. You know, there is a benefit to it. I'm very glad that I did it, because it laid this incredible foundation for me. But at the same time, I feel like I got out of it at the right time, where I didn't continue to get sucked into it for more years afterwards. I made the realization like, oh shit, there's like nothing, there's no there in terms of like story. There's there in terms of world building, but that's not enough. And so Spore City and what became Mushroom Blues was based on, this world is fucking awesome, but how can I bring in these genres that I love? And we'll talk about that more in the masterclass.
What I was going to say, first of all, we'll talk about the genre yeah, mashing together, yeah, a little more in part two. So tune in next week, make sure for that. But I do think that your experience with world building is applicable for other writers. And I'll tell you why, because I think it's a more common experience than you may think, or than anyone may think. Writing your first project, or, you know, really starting to get serious about writing for the first time, a lot of times that book, whatever the project you're working on, the travelogue that you were putting together, right? That's not the vibe. And it can be so easy to get disheartened and go, oh my gosh, I've put all this time and work into this, and now I'm not going to see any payoff from it.
Right, right.
And I think that there's a dangerous, or not dangerous, but it's a line you have to toe between a sunk cost fallacy, right? Where you go, well, I've put all this time in, I better double down and write this travelogue, which is what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Versus going, okay, well, how can I pivot this, right? Like I can still use this world, just because, you know, elements X, Y, and Z aren't working doesn't mean elements A, B, and C need to go. We don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? So I think that's a great message for listeners that may be working on, you know what I mean, one of their first projects or any project, right? Like I have projects I've worked on where I'm like, this world is dope. I have one actually I've tried to write three times so far. Three different stories set in the same world, and none of them are working. But the someday, baby, I'm putting something in this world.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing, is it's like you just keep it in your little back pocket and you pull it out when you want to.
Yeah. But I feel like I narrowly avoided the trap.
Getting stuck on that travelogue.
Getting stuck on that travelogue, or just being like far too obsessive about deepening the world and what have you. Because the world was already fucking deep. Like the world is like, there is
deeper such than we'll ever make on the page, I'm sure.
Exactly. But at the same time, it's like, I feel like what ended up in Mushroom Blues is so, it's so multi-layered. It's like what we were talking about so with Robert Jackson Bennett about having implied history and implied world building and these kinds of things. That is something that I really honed with Mushroom Blues. Such that it's like the world feels so rich, but there's so much that is only spoken about in passing, or, you know, and it's like, it will be fleshed, like things will be fleshed out more over the course of this series and other series within the Fungalverse. But I didn't need to dump everything that I'd created onto the page. And I didn't need to spend more time world building or obsessing over this project that wasn't working, and actually just start writing something that is far more interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also great advice, right? That you don't want to info dump. And that can be so hard when you've spent so much time building this beautiful multi-layered world. But you do such a great job in Mushroom Blues with just kind of throwing in casual mentions of a thing that happened in the past or of a location that we don't go to, but like it just gives this sense that the world is bigger. And as the reader, you have to trust the reader as a writer. And as a reader, you have to trust the writer, right? That the reader will figure it out and the writer will reveal more to you when it's time.
They will lead you along. They won't lead you astray.
Yes, right? You're like, you are safe in my hands, reader. I have to know, though, real quick before I move on, was that dream about the giant mushroom raining spores down in the forest, was that the origin of your mushroom love, or were you already very interested in mushrooms before that dream?
No. Mushrooms has been like my entire life.
That's been forever. Okay.
Yeah.
I was just came from a dream.
Yeah. No, like since I was a kid, like, exploring the forests in British Columbia and like stumbling across mushrooms and turning over logs and picking up bugs and shit. And, you know, it's like, what's this like alien looking thing, and like rip it apart and see what it's all about.
Oh,
yeah.
It's got all these gills and weird things in there. I love it. I love it. Well, I want to talk about the characters, because the characters in Mushroom Blues are fantastic. We've talked a little bit about Hoffman already. We've mentioned Koji. We've kind of talked about a few characters in passing, but I want to dig in a little deeper. Which character came to you first? It sounds like Koji, because he exists in Spore City as well. But how did you flesh out the full cast? Like, how did that come to be?
A lot of it was, this is like the most pantsy stuff I do. Like the framework of a story is more or less like something that I have an idea of, but characters are what come out of nowhere. And there are dozens of characters in Mushroom Blues that the story kind of created through narrative necessity. It's like, Koji was super strong in my head. I had already had a big backstory for him and everything that happened to him. Like, he fought in the Spore War, and his, you know, kind of relationship with the city. But then I, like, over the course of writing Mushroom Blues, I was like, his family started becoming a deeper part of it. Characters that just came from nowhere. Like, one of my favorites is this character called Rio. And she,
Rio came from nowhere. Oh, I love Rio.
Rio just, like, she was so spontaneous, and she just leapt off the page.
She's and great. Yeah.
Became the kind of character where it was like, I'm going to flesh you out in the sequels because I adore you. And yeah, so many of the characters that appear in the book, you know, like, the basic ones were Henrietta, obviously, Koji, Captain Ridgway, who's the captain of the homicide department, the homicide division in the Neokonoko police department. The baddies, like, I'm not gonna name who they are, but there are two baddies who are in this book who appear in Spore City as well. So they'd already been created.
Ooh, okay. But I didn't know they were from Spore City. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. But so many of them were just spontaneous. And I love that. That the narrative can be more firmly grounded, but the characters just kind of appear and breathe life into it. And so through the sort of, like, iterative process of drafting and then coming through revision, it was like, okay, you, like, there's something about you and I need to kind of, like, flesh you out more. Or, like, some of the biggest twists in the book are from characters that didn't exist when the first draft was finished. So, like, so much of it was spontaneous. And that is, like, for me, that is the kind of discovery writing, like we talked about with Hannah Long, that really enhances the potency of a story. Because if you can have characters that leap off the page for you, and you're able to kind of, like, double down on that, then chances are they're going to leap off the page more for the readers too.
Absolutely. I love that. We're starting from an outline, and then, but there are always going to be things that
are discovered through.
They sprout up like little mushrooms.
Yeah. Like mushrooms after rain. They'll just pop up out of the ground. Yeah.
Yeah. And you just got to roll with the punches on that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, as we kind of wind down here for part one of our chat, I have to ask, if you can only pick one thing, readers only take one thing away from their experience reading Mushroom Blues, what do you hope that is?
Can I give two?
Sure,
I'll try and make it like a conjoined conjoined.
I'll answer. Let you cheat. We'll do two.
It's my podcast. No, I'm kidding. It's ours.
Yeah, right? You're like, I do what I want.
I'm editing this shit. So it's, yeah, I'll make it like a twofold answer, but they'll be connected. One of the biggest things for me is that readers come away from it viewing mushrooms with more curiosity. Whether the book disgusts you, and I'm pretty sure many parts of it will, I'm hoping that I incorporated enough scenes where the beauty of mushrooms comes through, the sublime nature of these organisms comes through, so that even if someone is disgusted by them on, like, one end of the spectrum, on the other end of the spectrum, they're, like, in awe of these organisms, and that would encourage them to look into mushrooms more deeply outside of this book and on their own time. And at the same time, you know, Henrietta's experience of awakening and how that relates to my own experiences with psychedelics creates even more depth to the ways in which mushrooms can not just affect the world in the sense of mushrooms being like the prime decomposers on this planet and allowing forests and different vital biomes to thrive, as opposed to being, like, inundated with fucking leaves and dead animals and stuff like that. they shaped our world. But at the same time, through things like psychedelics, mushrooms can shape individuals. And so I feel that there are ways in which mushrooms can change the world, whether it's on an individual level or a community level or on an ecosystem level or on a global level. There are just so many ways in which mushrooms can completely colonize us, but in a good way, as opposed to like, they're going to infect you and shit. No,
right. Like, as opposed to in the Last of Us kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're not talking like cordyceps zombies, you know, or anything like right. that. We're talking about, you know, optimism and the ways in which mushrooms can right. help
positive
to
life perceptions.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The future's fungal, man. The future is fungal.
The future is fungal. Fungal. Well, speaking of the future, oh my gosh, accidental perfect transition.
You got this. Can you tell You're killing us it as
a little? I'm crushing it, right? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next? It sounds like it may be Spore City. Is that what's coming up? Do you have another timeline of when you may be releasing another project, just so we can all get excited for book two from Mr. Gibson?
I have like a Word doc that is far too long with years of ideas.
Publishing schedule.
Yeah. And publishing schedule and everything. But yeah, next thing is going to be like both Spore City, which is the start of the Kanoko trilogy. It's set 30 years after Mushroom Blues. And that one is really digging deeper into cyberpunk, but kind of taking it from the angle of like biotech and fungal tech and how that plays into corrupt corporations. And there's corporate espionage. There are, like fungal crime families that it's like expanding upon stuff that was established in Mushroom Blues, but it's much more kind of comprehensive in scale. And then Koji makes his return as an older grizzled detective. And I'm just really excited to, I have that whole trilogy planned out. Like it's already mapped out.
Oh, I'm so excited.
And then I'm going to basically go back and forth between the Kanoko trilogy and the Hoffman Report. So I have four books planned for the Hoffman Report, and all of those are mapped out, sort of generally mapped out with Koji and Henrietta solving a case per book, but an overarching story connecting all four of them. And then, so it'll be Spore City, hopefully like fall of this year or early 2025. And I'll also be writing a novelette that is tied into Mushroom Blues. So it's like kind of like an adjacent story about a sushi chef who is blackmailed into assassinating a political figure, which is
oh my god, I love it.
Yeah, gonna be very fun. Very fun.
You
write.
Told me a little bit about this novelette, and I'm very excited for it.
It's called A Tale of Fish and Fungi. So that one will be released just through that will be an actual newsletter sign up freebie.
That will be the freebie. We've come full circle back to the real freebie now.
Yeah. So it's like everything comes full circle. It's great. We just talked to Moses Owusu-Tomi. It's like, everything's about circles.
Circular.
So, yeah. But then like, I've got tons of stuff planned. Like I have like 11, I think like 9 books and 2 short story collections kind of, you know, planned out for the Fungalverse. But then I have other series that are, you know, like near future sci-fi set in Earth, you know, like a cyberpunk kind of conspiracy mystery series, some fantasy stuff, and then hopefully like collaborating with some friends on co-authored projects and maybe a comic book at some point. Who knows?
Hell yeah. Say with your art skills, comic book would be a natural fit. Well, to you know, the Cliff's notes there is we have definitely not seen the last of Adrian M. Gibson's published works with Mushroom Blues. I'm very excited to see all of the cool stuff you come out with.
Yeah.
So to close us out for episode 1, can you give listeners A good bit of soundbite writing advice, and B, tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating.
Okay. So writing advice, I think, yeah, I want to do something that I haven't said on any other podcast. I feel like we had like some good writing advice here as well.
Oh yeah. We get greedy though. I feel like we always get good writing advice from our guests, and then we're like, give us one more though.
Yeah.
So I'm greedy. Give me one more.
Okay. So this one is going to be about you as a writer and the flexibility that you allow yourself. And this is directly applicable to things I've been saying throughout this, but it's like, never define yourself as a pantser or a plotter, because you're never going to be pigeonholed to one of them. Allow yourself the flexibility to explore whichever different facets of the story are speaking to you most strongly, and the approach that is most seamless and comfortable for that particular part of the story. So for me, it helps so much to not burden myself with the need to have every single detail plotted out. The fact that I could be a plotter in terms of my outlining, but also be a discovery writer in terms of how a scene plays out and the characters that emerge from that, gave me much more satisfaction as an author, because those were some of the best moments. Those were the moments where I was like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah, when then you're like, this is why I do this, right?
This
like,
is
this
why
is
I
what
do
makes
this
yeah. fun. Yep.
There were many times during the writing of Mushroom Blues where I was floored by the emergence of a character or the actions of a character. And there were specific scenes in Mushroom Blues that I finished writing and I just cried. I was like, you know, it broke me. Like I mentioned earlier, this book broke me in a lot of ways, but I feel stronger for what it became and how it challenged me and how it made me a better writer and a more confident writer. So I feel like denying yourself the flexibility to explore the approaches that best fit a moment, best fit a scene, chapter, whatever. Or even if it's like first draft versus revision, giving yourself that flexibility at different points throughout the writing process will allow you to write more confidently and less likely to drown yourself in writer's block and those kinds of things. So, yeah. And now random fact.
Amazing. Yeah. That's a great piece of writing advice, though. I love that. You know, it kind of speaks to that what we always say, where it's like, you know, don't listen to super dogmatic writing advice, mm-hmm. even from yourself, though. I think that's kind of, you know, what you're saying. Don't let yourself be pigeonholed. All right. Yeah. Weird or random fact. If it's not about mushrooms, I'm going to be really disappointed.
It is about mushrooms. Okay.
Yes.
Mushrooms, mushrooms and humans. Okay. So mushrooms are more genetically similar to humans than they are to plants.
Ooh, creepy.
I don't know if you know that. Yeah.
So I didn't. I knew that they were more similar to humans than like something else is to humans. I forget what the something else was though.
Don't
Maybe
know.
Plants as well.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, mushrooms, it's like they, like humans, they breathe in oxygen and they exhale carbon dioxide. The genetic makeup of them is like on a DNA level is much closer to humans than it is to plants, which is kind of fucked up in the sense of like these organisms feel so alien, but at the same time, it's like we have so much shared history with these things, which is another facet of why I was so excited to be able to present a world and this race of people, the fungals, who are symbiotically merged with mushrooms to the point where it completely altered their biology. And so, yeah, that was like one of those facts where it kind of infected my mind. And I was like, you know, what if these two organisms were to combine. And I just think it's beautiful that all life on our planet is interconnected in some way. But that we can find still so much mystery in it. And fiction is one of the greatest ways to explore that.
That's a beautiful way of describing a random fact that was unsettling at first. I love that.
You're almost a mushroom, MJ.
I know. You know what? I am honored to be almost a mushroom after this conversation. Well, Adrian, thank you for spilling your secrets for us today. Aww. And anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more every month, you can hear an exclusive reading by Adrian.
Yeah.
A part of Chapter 3 of Mushroom Blues. Mm-hmm. So, Adrian, can you please let everyone know where they can find you online?
Here. That's part of it. Every week you can find me here. You can find me here. And you can find me at Adrian M. Gibson on all the socials. You can check out my website, adrianmgibson.com. I have an online store there where you can get some cool merch from Mushroom Blues, but also just like other stuff, tattoo designs, all kinds of things. Mushroom Blues is out today in ebook. It's going to be out in the next couple days in paperback, hardcover on April 2nd, audiobook on April 16th, which I'm narrating myself. As well, today you can stream or buy the Mushroom Blues soundtrack, which was produced and composed by Spore, two of my amazingly talented friends over in Sweden. That's on Bandcamp if you want to pick up the digital album. It's on Apple Music. On Bandcamp, you can also pick up the limited edition cassette tape of the soundtrack. And then it's on Spotify and all the streaming platforms. So lots of goodies, man. Lots of goodies.
All the goodies. Yes. Yeah. Make sure you check out the website and the merch, everybody, because Adrian's art style is so cool. Awesome. Yes. So everyone go grab your copy of Mushroom Blues. Again, if you haven't yet, what are you doing? You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, and Blue Sky at SFF Addicts Pod, or you can follow me at MJ Kuhn Books. And that's it for this episode. So stay tuned for next week for part two with Adrian and our mini masterclass on genre mashups.
Genre blending.
Now keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.